Hello, it's John Dennis on Wednesday the 23rd of September. Today, pressure on the Home Secretary Alan Johnson after French riot police remove hundreds of migrants from the camp near Calais known as the Jungle.
The problem lies not in the height of the wire border fences at Calais, but in the lack of a European asylum policy.
Also today, at the Climate Change Summit in New York, China sets out a new plan to tackle global warming.
There's not the specifics here that the world might have wanted to see, but it is a step in the right direction.
And I'm Michael White in Bournemouth with the Liberal Democrats on a big day for leader Nick Clegg, his latest big chance to showcase his policies with a general election only months away.
The first thing I think he's probably got to do is to prove to the party and to the country that he is indeed the Liberal Democrat leader.
But first, it's Bill Overton with the news headlines.
The Prime Minister's offering to cut back the Trident nuclear missile programme as Britain's contribution to disarmament. He'll make the proposal to the UN Security Council meeting on Thursday. It would mean reducing the number of nuclear weapons-carrying submarines from 4 to 3. The cutback may only be the start, the Guardian's been told. The move would save over £5 billion. Sydney, the largest city in Australia, has been almost closed down by dust storms, the worst in over 50 years. A pall of red dust blown in from the outbacks clogged the skies and closed the international airport. Even ferry services have been halted because of bad visibility. The ambulance service reports many people suffering from breathing difficulties. The deposed president of Honduras is under siege by soldiers in the Brazilian embassy in the capital, Tegucigalpa. The interim president's called for him to be handed over and has ordered the army to clear the streets of his supporters. Manuel Zelaya is now cut off with 70 supporters without water, electricity or phones. Brazil has asked the UN Security Council to intervene. Back here in Britain, the CBI says the recession will be over by Christmas. The Organisation of Business Leaders reports the economy has started growing again. Meanwhile, the head of the city watchdog has called for radical change in the financial sector. The chairman of the Financial Services Authority, Lord Turner, said in a speech at the Mansion House that British citizens would be paying for years for the crisis, which had been cooked up in trading rooms. He insisted the industry needs to regain the country's trust. But the city's own pink paper, the Financial Times, leads today with Gordon Brown's offer to reduce the Trident missile programme, calling it an attempt to speed up the global arms talks. The Times says that Brown hopes the move will be an example to others in his nuclear overture. Our paper argues he's following US President Obama's lead, and the Independent reckons all five permanent members of the UN Security Council will become involved in a plan where they'll all ban the bomb. The Telegraph and Mail focus on the case of the Attorney General, Baroness Scotland, who was fined yesterday for employing an illegal immigrant. The Telegraph says she is being urged to quit by fellow ministers. The Mail names her Baroness Shameless for insisting breaking the law she helped to frame was no worse than forgetting to pay the congestion charge. The Telegraph rounds the story off with a report the illegal immigrant from Tonga has no plans to return home, claiming she's on the run from the authorities. Finally, our paper warns us not to get sick in the first week in August. An NHS study has shown at that time every year a fresh crop of junior doctors arrive on the wards. Unfortunately, that coincides with a 6% increase in hospital deaths. More news and sport throughout the day on guardian.co.uk.
Later on in the show, we'll be hearing from Michael White and the Guardian's politics team with the Liberal Democrats in Bournemouth. First, hundreds of illegal migrants have spent the night dispersed around France after riot police demolished the so-called jungle camp at Calais. Shortly after dawn yesterday, 278 people were removed, nearly half of them aged under 18. Angelique Chrysaphis describes the scene.
Well, first of all, you have to picture the jungle camp. Now, there's some beautiful coastline in Calais beside the port, but above that is a series of big sand dunes. It's a wooded area with trees, and it's basically become a tent city of bits of makeshift plastic, litter. There's no running water, and there have been, in recent months, about 800 people camped out in scattered areas across these dunes.
It's so difficult to live here because everyone have health problem, shoes problem, clothes problem. It's very dangerous jungle. I'm also afraid in the days in this jungle.
Stop deportation! No border! No nation!
Now, police at 7:30 a.m., they waited until dawn. They moved in to clear the biggest area, which is populated by Pashtuns. there were some violent scenes because there were some no border protesters demonstrating there, and police quickly moved them out of the way. And then there were scenes with Afghan migrants crying, not wanting to leave, but the police simply carried them away. And there were buses waiting to take some to detention centres and others to homes where people under 18 will be housed.
And you've spoken to some of the people involved. What have they been saying?
Well, there's been a lot of upset, but the interesting thing here, and it's what a lot of critics of this movement are saying, of this government move are saying, is that this was basically a massive PR exercise. Now, the French government let it be known last week and even earlier that they were going to be moving in to bulldoze the jungle, and that's exactly what they've been doing. They've been cutting down trees and bulldozing these camps. So when they arrived, instead of 800 people, naturally there were about 270. 278 people were arrested. Now, what happened to the others? Some of them have been trying to get over to England by stowing away in ferries in recent days, and there are rumours that a few, the handfuls here and there, have been getting through. And I've been speaking to others who actually fled down on the train and are sleeping rough in Paris. They've been describing horrific conditions with no running water, where they're sleeping on the streets. They are waiting to go back to Calais and start the process again. And NGOs are saying, really, this has helped nothing, because soon they will be back up there.
Angelique, many thanks. Well, with me in the studio is Alan Travis, our Home Affairs editor. Well, Alan, this camp had become really a symbol of the inability of the French and the British authorities to deal with these migrants.
That's the argument that's been made in favour of closing it down and clearing it. But in effect, this is almost a sort of public relations as a police operation that's taken place both in France and in Britain. There's been formed joint ministerial meetings between the two countries over the last few months. The problem lies not in the height of the wire border fences at Calais, but in the lack of a European asylum policy, in a way, in that the French essentially have failed to process or accept any asylum claims from those who are in this camp for as long as up to 8 months, the UNHCR tell us. And in that basis, it's very difficult for them to claim asylum in France. Many are brought over by people traffickers with the aim of being brought to London, told they're going to be brought to London. And so naturally, they have the expectation that they're going to try and get here.
I mean, that was the reason. Another reason for closing it down was that the place was prone to people traffickers, and that there was a danger that they'd be brought here illegally.
Well, it was a very insanitary place. It was obviously a very unpleasant place. And you have to remember, back in history, 7 years ago, a Red Cross camp, which was habitable, was closed down by agreement between Nicolas Sarkozy and David Blunkett on similar grounds.
That was at Songgat.
Songgat, yes, just outside Calais, near the Coquel train terminal. What was different on that occasion was that, as part of that deal, David Blunkett allowed most of those people who were actually in the camp to come to Britain and to make a claim for asylum. This time we're seeing both Alan Johnson and his immigration minister Phil Wallis deny that right for them to claim asylum in Britain. And indeed, yesterday Phil Wallis was, and to a lesser extent Alan Johnson, explicitly rejecting the idea they could possibly be asylum seekers and describing them as illegal migrants. Naturally, refugee welfare groups like the Refugee Council, Refugee Action, were extremely indignant at this. They said this was the government prejudging the question of whether or not these people, mostly from Afghanistan, some from Iraq, others from Eritrea, all well-known troubled spots, problems, less to be a question of economic migration, more a question perhaps of fleeing persecution.
Alan Travis, and there's full coverage today at guardian.co.uk/UK. Also on The Guardian's website, John Henley looks at the changing relationship between teacher and pupil. Have your say on that at guardian.co.uk/education. After the Sugar Babes sack their last remaining original member, we ask, when is a band not a band? Guardian.co.uk/music. And Alistair McGowan on how football ruined his marriage. Guardian.co.uk/sport. Next on Guardian Daily, we go to Michael White, The Guardian's assistant editor. He's at the Liberal Democrat conference this week.
I'm here in the Bournemouth International Conference Centre, outside the main hall, where later today Clegg will set out his party's priority as they head for the general election campaign. Part of the challenge the Lib Dems face is getting the recognition they feel they deserve, but does anyone actually recognise them? I took to the seafront here in Bournemouth to find out what people not attending the Lib Dem conference know about the Lib Dems.
Nothing.
Did you know it was being held here?
No, not until I saw a few people walking around with labels on Saturday.
But you live in Bournemouth?
I worked on the beach.
You look as if you work on the beach from that suntan. You're wearing it under those shorts.
But there's been no publicity whatsoever. Nothing in the local papers, no flyers.
Excuse me, we're here from The Guardian. We're interviewing people who are not delegates at the Liberal Democrat Conference. You don't look as if you're a delegate at the Liberal Democrat Conference.
No, I'm not.
What are you doing here?
I'm not a delegate, but I'm with the New Economics Foundation. We've got fringe events on.
Do you know all the Liberal Democrat leadership? You could name the top three, for example.
Only Clegg.
Only Clegg? Not even Vince?
Vince.
Can we ask you what you know about the Liberal Democrat Conference?
Not an awful lot, really. I've just what I've seen in the paper and on TV.
Have you been to a Liberal Democrat Conference before?
No, I haven't. No.
And this is your first year as a trainee journalist on The Echo?
It's my first year.
How's it going?
Not too bad. It would have been better if they'd given me a press pass to get in there.
They didn't give you a press pass? That's awful. Do you want to borrow mine?
Oh, I could do that. It would be really good.
Yes, but you're not bald and have a moustache. We're from The Guardian. We're asking people who've got nothing to do with the Liberal Democrat Conference what they know about the Liberal Democrats. Do you know anything?
Nothing.
Not at all. Nick Clegg, you heard of him?
Yes.
Vince Cable, he's nice. Yes. He wants to tax all those people with big houses down at Sandbank.
We don't live there.
No, few of us do. We frightened them off there. They ran away. That's a merry-go-round. We could use the political metaphor, the political merry-go-round. There it is. Hardly anybody on it, though. It must be a Lib Dem merry-go-round. We're from The Guardian. We're asking people who are not going to the Liberal Democrat Conference what they know about the Liberal Democrats, if anything at all. You don't win one of those big houses that Vince Cable wants to tax, do you?
No. Everyone keeps saying that. Do we live in Sandbanks? And I say, no, I live in Poole.
Have you heard of Vince Cable, the Liberal Democrat Treasury man?
Yes, I like Vince Cable, actually.
What do you like about him?
He's very sensible. He's very, obviously very intelligent, but he's also got a good background behind him. Yes, I think he's very good, actually.
Have you heard of Nick Clegg, his boss, his party leader?
Yes.
He's the better looking one.
Yes, I know, but I prefer Vince Cable.
Yes, everybody does.
Yes.
There you go. Thank you very much. Do you live here in the town?
Yes.
We're from The Guardian. We're asking people who are not delegates at the Liberal Democrat Conference. You must have seen a few of these conferences.
Yes, staying in the Hermitage where I live.
That's right. There are a lot of them in there. You live in the hotel, do you?
Yes, I do.
So you walk down to the beach every morning for your constitutional.
I do.
You're looking very well on it. How old are you?
Oh, I'm 90 next year.
Well, you're looking very well on 90. Who's the first Liberal leader? Can you remember Lloyd George?
Lloyd George, yes.
Did you like
now,
him?
My mother was always what we called Liberal in those days.
Yes, we did.
Well, everything has changed in my lifetime, you see, so really now I'm a Tory.
Okay, well, that happens too in life, doesn't it?
The Lib Dems were in here, and what I didn't like was they gave permission for another casino.
This is the council, was it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Are they not in charge of the council anymore?
No, we've got the Tories in.
Not perhaps the ringing endorsement of liberal democracy, which the Lib Dems are looking for, but then this is a Tory-held part of Britain. And Nick Clegg has tiptoed away from his comments about savage cuts made in an interview with The Guardian at the weekend, and there's been some confusion about the party's so-called mansion tax. I'm joined by The Guardian's political columnist Martin Kettle. Martin, what's Nick Clegg got to do today?
I think the first thing I think he's probably got to do is to prove to the party and to the country that he is indeed the Liberal Democrat leader. I mean, we know he is the leader, but over the first 12 months of his leadership, I think he was rather eclipsed by Vince Cable, and he was sort of learning the job. I think this speech is a really important pre-election opportunity to show that, you know, he is the man to lead the Liberal Democrats into the future, whatever that holds.
Well, he's still got a Vince problem. Cable had a good recession. He didn't get it all right. In fact, he made some horrible mistakes, like everybody else has done. But, you know, he's a proper economist and he talks well and he has a sort of moral compass which impresses ordinary voters. We've just been talking to them out on the street. Vince is the one they know, and Mr. Clegg is much younger. I thought he's been more confident and sounded more assured here in Bournemouth this week. Others say no, he's still a long-winded ditherer.
No, I think that the two of them have recognised that they have to work together, that that they are going to be a team in the election. I think, you know, Vince Cable is going to be right up there at every big public
on the front of the bus with him. They're travelling two or three days a week on the bus. It's actually generous of Clegg. I mean, Clegg has shown maturity letting Cable steal his limelight. We know plenty of politicians who would find that intolerable.
Yes, I don't think you or I would need to think very long before we came up with some names of people who would never wish to do that. But
we'll leave Gordon Brown out of this conversation.
We won't mention those words.
What about policy, though? What distinctive things have the Lib Dems got to find? I felt that Clegg at the beginning of the week, when he talked about these horrible cuts they were going to have to make, that he was sounding a little shrill, trying to out-Tory the Tories, whereas Charles Kennedy was here this week reminding him that essentially they're a party of the left. Don't go near any coalitions with the Tories, he said. We had distinctive policies in 2005, opposition to the Iraq War, and opposition to student tuition fees did us very well in Scotland. You know, you've got to be distinctive, and you've got to, as you say, to be the leader.
Well, I think Charles Kennedy's record looks perhaps a little bit better in retrospect than it did at the time. I mean, just on the question of Iraq, he had to be dragged kicking and screaming into that particular...
Not least by the Guardian.
Not least by the Guardian, as you and I both know. But I think in answer to your bigger question, I think there are two ways of looking at the way that things have gone for Clegg this week and this left-right question for the Liberal Democrats. One way is to say that he went too hard to the right and then they panicked, and so he's tried to row back, and they've tried to compensate by being more socially progressive. They have to change. You know, it's a lesson that all the parties are having to adjust with greater or lesser enthusiasm depending on where they're coming from ideologically.
Martin Kettle's take on things. We've had scant overnight briefing about what Clegg is actually going to say, but I gather one thing he will do is to address voters who quite like Lib Dem politics and policies but don't actually vote Lib Dem. Think again, he's going to say. Meanwhile, one thing we can expect to hear today, apart from the leader, is plenty about civil liberties. They're more or less revenue neutral, after all, and they matter to Lib Dem activists. Yesterday, Clegg was put through his paces by Liberty's Shami Chakrabarti.
No Liberal Democrat leader, for completely obvious, legitimate, understandable reasons, ever wants to speculate about
is it the whole Parliament question?
Or about coalition. And I'm not going to ask you, you know, which ugly sister you want to kiss and all of that stuff, right? I've heard all of those answers from your predecessors, but if the Human Rights Act is as fundamental as you're saying, is it a deal breaker with either party in the future if they want to sacrifice it and they want you in government? Is it a deal breaker?
To be honest, there are so many things that I think we believe in that they don't believe in. Human Rights Act, political reform, fairer taxes, complete step change in our relationship with Europe. I just, you know, it's invidious for me to sort of... We're not a one-trick pony.
Meanwhile, in the conference hall, the keynote speaker was Chris Huhne, the man who narrowly missed out on Nick Clegg's job in the last leadership contest, although some say he'd have won when the postal votes were counted. And Huhne was in no mood to be wooed by the so-called Tory love-bombing campaign. Here he is.
What do the Tories stand for when they criticise Labour's child poverty record but admit that benefits and pensions will bear the full brunt of their cuts? When they berate city bonuses but refuse any action against them? When they oppose the surveillance state but want to make police snooping easier? When they say they are progressive but want to shrink the means of giving people a helping hand up? This is policy by focus group, not principle. It's all things to all men. The Tories take up as many positions as the Kama Sutra.
Chris Huhne. And if that didn't quite raise the roof, you can expect more counter-strikes against those Tory love bombers today.
Michael White in Bournemouth. My name's John Dennis. Still to come in Guardian Daily, we hear from the investigative journalist who first questioned the business practices of the now disgraced financier Bernard Madoff.
The strangest part was that Madoff swore his investors to secrecy. He requested that they not tell anyone he was their portfolio manager.
But first, at the Climate Change Summit in New York, President Barack Obama has told world leaders that global warming presents a grave threat that demands immediate action.
The threat from climate change is serious, it is urgent, and it is growing. Our generation's response to this challenge will be judged by history.
More than 100 world leaders are trying to move forward on climate change this week ahead of the Copenhagen summit in December. Yesterday, China, which emits more carbon than any other country, set its first ever global warming target. Suzanne Goldenberg, our US environment correspondent, is in New York with the details.
China, for the first time, is making a commitment to cut its carbon emissions. Now, you have to qualify this a bit. They are saying by a notable margin. So there's not the specifics here that the world might have wanted to see, but it is a step in the right direction. In his speech, the Chinese leader Hu Jintao also said that China would increase amount of electricity that it got from renewable energy sources like solar and wind power to 15% of its total by 2020.
And this follows also moves by India, the other big developing nation, to introduce new laws to cut its greenhouse gases.
Right. I spoke to India's environment minister, Jairam Ramesh, the other day, and he sort of set out quite a detailed program where India, too, would reduce its greenhouse gas emissions. But, like China, India isn't giving a specific target. So these are both positive moves, but you know, they have to be viewed with caution. Unless they're committing to a specific target, you don't know what the outcome is going to be, and you don't know if it's going to be able to do enough to bring down the greenhouse gases that are causing global warming in time.
And what about the United States? Because there's huge pressure on Barack Obama to deliver cuts in America's emissions.
Right, and there was a poignant line in his speech when he said, you know, that different nations had to act at different speeds. Barack Obama, despite his own personal desire to act quickly on global warming, is hamstrung. The Senate is delaying action on climate change legislation that would commit America to the actions that are needed to be able to get a treaty in place on global warming at Copenhagen. And unless the Senate moves, Barack Obama can't deliver.
But overall, Susie, some positive movements towards a global deal in December.
I think so. You know, this summit started with Ban Ki-moon complaining that talks were moving slower than a glacier.
Failure to reach broad agreement in Copenhagen would be morally inexcusable, economically short-sighted, and politically unwise.
Whether it's enough to really push these talks forward is going to emerge only once leaders sort of digest what's going on in the behind-door negotiations and after the meeting of the G20 leaders at Pittsburgh later in the week.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
The Wall Street broker Bernard Madoff was jailed in June after defrauding thousands of investors of a total of $65 billion. Back in 2001, the financial journalist Erin Arvedland was the first to question the way Madoff operated. After hundreds of interviews with Madoff's victims and associates, she's now written a book about him. So, what made her first realise that there was something wrong?
Well, there were several things that didn't add up about Bernie Madoff's supposed billion-dollar hedge fund. I got a tip from a very good source who worked at Deutsche Bank back in 2001. He was, in fact, trading these exotic instruments that Madoff claimed to be trading. My source at Deutsche Bank, a man by the name of Ken Nakayama, showed me some of the returns that Madoff claimed to be getting, and they weren't particularly astronomical, but they never lost money. So that was the first red flag. The second was interviews with some of his investors. And the strangest part was that Madoff swore his investors to secrecy. He requested that they not tell anyone he was their portfolio manager, which, as you know, on Wall Street or in the city, is very unusual. And then finally, I couldn't find anyone on Wall Street who had traded with him on the advisory side. What's so confusing about the story was that Madoff did have a very legitimate and profitable brokerage firm. So it really boggles the mind as to why he even bothered. with this phony hedge fund. But in fact, he was claiming to trade options for his hedge fund, but in fact had never made a trade.
And it's hard to believe now, but he was hailed as a financial genius.
That's true. And his firm was, in fact, an innovator on Wall Street. Bernie Madoff and his brother Peter really pushed computerized trading about 10 years before the rest of Wall Street even thought it was really possible or would replace manual or paper trading. So for that reason, they were really hailed as pillars of Wall Street.
Now, you've been investigating further, obviously, for this book. When did Madoff begin his Ponzi scheme?
I speculate in the book about Madoff that he began in the early 1960s, that the scam actually dated back to the very beginnings of his firm when he and his new wife, Ruth Madoff, began the firm and were operating out of her father's accounting practice.
And what does Madoff himself say about when he began running the scheme?
He has lied consistently. So everything that he says, we have to take with a grain of salt. Madoff claimed that he acted alone, and we now know that that's impossible.
And does that account for the fact that he managed to continue this fraud for so long?
Yeah, he could not have done it alone, and he didn't. He had the help of his right-hand man, Frank DiPasquale, a staff of people on one floor, while above, on the other two floors, Madoff was running a very legitimate brokerage firm, which is what made it so hard to find. And yet, Madoff was able to deceive the Securities and Exchange Commission for decades.
And apart from, obviously, the fact that he made pots of money, what was his motive?
Good question. Why did he bother? I mean, the phony hedge fund was probably more work than actually just running a real fund. My best guess is that he felt like he was doing his investors a favor. He had some elements of, I guess, what we would call today a sociopath or psychopath, which is he was very arrogant, he lacked empathy for his victims, and he felt very much above everyone else, but the rules did not apply.
Erin Arvidland and her book Madoff, The Man Who Stole $65 Billion, is published by Penguin. The producers of today's edition of Guardian Daily were Francesca Panetta and Tim Mabey, and in Bournemouth, Phil Maynard. I'm John Dennis. Thanks for listening.